at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW-Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, vice president for community and government relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. On today's program, we'll be sharing information about the 126-year-old institution that most people in Southeast Wisconsin have never heard of. It is nestled on the shore of Lake Geneva Lake in Williams Bay. This architectural and scientific gem was also featured in a 1996 Keanu Reeves Morgan Freeman film. And in December, I got to take a tour of the facility and then stood outside on the grounds and watched as the final strands of melted green glass were added to the world's tallest glass tree. What is this mystery institution? It is the Yerkes Observatory, currently undergoing a renaissance under the leadership of our guest, Amanda Bauer. Dr. Amanda Bauer is the Montgomery Foundation Deputy Director for Yerkes Observatory and the Head of Science and Education. Amanda received her PhD in astrophysics from the University of Texas at Austin, studying variations in how galaxies form, how they live their lives, and how they evolve into the diverse array of galaxy species we see today. Before coming to Wisconsin and Yerkes, Dr. Bauer worked as the Deputy Director of Operations for the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile, one of the largest and most anticipated astronomy projects under construction in the world. In 2015, while serving as the first ever outreach officer for the Australian Astronomy Observatory in Sydney, she was named one of the top five under 40 researchers and science communicators in Australia. Wow. So welcome, Amanda Bauer.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there might be listeners who've never even heard of this place, Yerkes Observatory. So let's kind of give them the capsule summary about what Yerkes Observatory is. Where is it? Why is it there? What is it for? What is its status today?
Yerkes Observatory is sort of colloquially known as the birthplace of modern astrophysics. It was founded in 1897 in Williams Bay, sort of about an hour away from Madison and Milwaukee and Chicago, depending on when you happen to hit traffic while you're traveling. It was built out here because it needed to be close enough to Chicago to satisfy the funder, who was Charles Yerkes, but far enough away that it wasn't enmeshed in the industrial soot that was around in the late 1890s. It was founded by George Ellery Hale, who was the astronomer at the University of Chicago, who had the vision of building the biggest telescope in the world. And he went on, Yerkes was the first time he built the biggest telescope in the world, and he went on to do that four different times. So he worked with the president of the University of Chicago, which was brand new at the time and had just opened, to see his vision for this observatory and to establish the university as an astrophysics leader by building the largest refracting telescope in the world. And it still is that today. No other refracting telescope has ever even been thought of to be built larger than the one that we have. The uniqueness of the place was also because it wasn't just the telescope. It wasn't just that one observatory. It was the entire building, which was extravagantly built from an architectural perspective on beautiful grounds. It had laboratories, it had classrooms, it had instrumentation. The astronomers came out here and lived and worked with engineers and with students. And so it really was able to contribute to world-leading astronomy research and instrumentation development for almost 100 years. So it's had quite a history.
Right. It was, I got a chance to tour it in December, but I also had been out there about 6 years ago. For a couple of different reasons, and it is a stunning property, as you said. Just the building itself is so unique and beautiful, but the grounds are also really lovely and right on the shore of the lake, with, you know, beautiful vistas looking out on the water, etc. So it is, it's just a beautiful place in general, but the telescopes, oh my goodness, they are so big. And the sort of ingenuity of the people in how they, there's actually an entire floor. It's so hard to explain. It's like if you thought of, you think of the telescope itself as the center of a bullseye, and then there's a big dome over the top. There's like an outer ring of the bullseye where the entire thing is an elevator, and it moves up so you can reach the height of the telescope. I can't even fully explain it. You can take a tour, which I'm sure we'll get into later, but it is even now 100 years, not something that's sort of up to date in the way that the place that you just came from in Chile is. It's still fascinating.
It's really fascinating. So I transitioned from arguably one of the most modern telescope projects in the world to this one, which is one of the most historic astronomical institutions. And I am consistently blown away the more I learn about the mechanical ingenuity and ability that they had in the late 1890s to produce this system. The electronics, it was founded using direct current, which was just becoming like a big thing at that time. They were sort of using things with direct current and then slowly starting to switch into alternating current. But we still power the lifting of that 90-foot diameter floor, wooden floor, and open that massive metal dome with a direct current motor that lives in the basement of the dome. So it just everything about how they managed to do it, the hands-on, the detail, the skill that must have been involved to get this metal and everything balanced. It's so well balanced. I mean, you walk into this dome and it's amazing the sounds that people make when they walk in and see the telescope for the first time, just in its majesty, but you can move it with your hands. It's so well balanced that I go to the end where you look through with your eye and there's sort of a handlebar ring around there and I can move the telescope up and down. And in fact, that's how I point the telescope at the targets that I want to look at. It's just incredible.
How much does it weigh? Do you know?
It weighs something like 20 tons. That's just the telescope tube.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So So that we just had, I warned Amanda that I was probably going to go off onto these sort of gushing asides because I'm so fascinated. I'm not even a scientist. I just think the whole thing is amazing. And that's why I wanted to do this program, to introduce other people and encourage you all to go out and see it, because we are really lucky to have this here. So let's just kind of focus on the scientific legacy of the Yerkes Observatory. You know, how was this facility different and better than most in its time?
Yeah, at the time, there were not really any other observatories that were built to include the laboratory, the machine shop, the optics, to have all the engineers and to have the astronomers live in the small town that Williams Bay was at the time and still is, embedded in the community. It just was a place where you were able to do big science. And right away, when it was founded, because of Hale's sort of exuberance and influence in the astronomical community, he was able to really talk up this new observatory. So right when it started, there was a huge ceremony to hand over the keys. There were discoveries immediately when it opened its eyes to the universe. It became the home base of the Astrophysical Journal, which is still one of the most widely used publications for professional astronomy today. And it held the inaugural meeting of the American Astronomical Society, which is still the largest U.S. professional astronomy organization. So right off the bat, its discoveries, its technologies, its reputation, and its ability to create new technology and to be innovative in what it was doing for astrophysics was there from the beginning.
So what are some of the firsts that were discovered or that occurred at Yerkes?
Well, I mean, the obvious is the biggest refracting telescope in the world. So that was fun. The group that was there early on really refined astrophotography using glass plates. So for decades, the images that would have been seen around the world of astronomical objects would have come from the Yerkes telescope. It was beautiful in the types of images that it was able to see visually. So as an astronomer, you could see these things, but that it could capture an image that you recorded and were able to share, that was completely new at that time. And so refining that process was something that Yerkes contributed. They also had an optical engineer on the team right at the beginning named Ritchie, and he was able to refine how we ground down glass and coated it with different coatings like aluminum so that it became a reflective surface, which is what reflecting telescopes use. And so after they built this big refractor, they moved on to the astronomical community at large using reflecting telescopes, largely because the process of building the mirrors and coating them and the design of the telescope was refined by the people at Yerkes. We had scientists, there was Frank Schlesinger, who pioneered a new reliable method to determine the distances to stars. You would think distance is such a, you know, an easy thing to tell, but in fact, it's one of the most difficult things to measure in all of the universe. And at this time, we didn't really have very many methods for how you do that. And so he pioneered a way to determine the distances to nearby stars. And this was a technique that was used the world over for a long time. And so Yerkes was able to measure the distances to stars and other properties of stars as a lead for probably 70 years. That was the major thing that they contributed over and over. The ways that people understood how stars worked were kind of derived from some of the observations that Yerkes was making. There was another famous astronomer, Barnard, who just took amazing photographs. I can look at some of the glass plates. So we have a collection of 180,000 glass plates. They're flat pieces of glass that are anywhere from a couple inches up to 10 inches across that have captured images of the universe over the last 125 years. And when I look through them, Barnard's ability to capture the magic of some of the outskirts of the Milky Way, for instance, was amazing. And he was the first one who was able to look at the darker patches of the sky and not think, oh, there are fewer stars there. No, that's actually a cloud of dust or gas that's blocking the starlight from behind it getting through. And so over the course of Yerkes' history, from Barnard on to Morgan and Nancy Grace Roman, they looked at stars using different techniques and were able to figure out the makeup of the Milky Way galaxy and that it was a spiral galaxy. That was founded by some of the mid-century scientists that were at Yerkes. So over and over again, throughout the course of 125 years, Yerkes just kind of reimagined itself. It used its facilities to innovate technology. Someone would get a good idea and there would be an engineer around to create an instrument that would help them make that measurement. And they would prototype something. And then maybe that scientist would take that prototyped instrument to another observatory and refine it and found entire fields of astronomy. So it's just incredible the influence that Yerkes had over the course of astronomy in kind of the modern era.
Yes, and I will emphasize, so you can take a tour of this. We'll give you more information at the end. And you can see some of these glass plates. That was one of the really great things. There's some really interesting displays, and I'm sure those are going to evolve and expand over time. But you can see some of this work and a lot of photos of these scientists at Yerkes in the displays with a timeline sort of explaining all of these discoveries as well. So it's sort of it's a working observatory, but it has such a long history that there's ample, I would say, tribute to its past built into the experience if you go for the tour. So I'm sure there are some listeners here who are really interested in science. Let me stop for a moment and do a quick reintroduction break, and then we'll talk about sort of some of the famous Yerkes folks. So you are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the renaissance of the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay in Walworth County is with Amanda Bauer, the Deputy Director and Head of Science and Education at Yerkes Observatory. And it is archived at WGTV.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTV Education Matters Facebook page and join in the discussion there. So what are some of the scientists or scientific findings that maybe our listeners would have heard about, you know, even just vaguely heard about?
I think a common name that most people know is Hubble, which was named after Edwin Hubble, who was a scientist starting in Chicago, but he did his graduate work at Yerkes Observatory. And so he took some of his first images that went on to help him understand that the universe was not just our Milky Way galaxy, but it was multiple, many millions of island universes, as he called them, and that the universe is expanding. So he started his career here at Yerkes Observatory. One of my favorites is Nancy Grace Roman. She was also a graduate student here in the 1950s. She contributed to some of the work on the discovery of spiral structure of our Milky Way galaxy and then went on to be NASA's first chief of astronomy. Not only that, but she, in that role, helped make sure that the Hubble Space Telescope was funded. And so she was hugely influential in actually launching our first big space telescope. And the next space telescope that will be launched in a few years from now will be named after her. So you'll hear a lot more about the Roman telescope in the next few years. And it was after her and starting with her work that she did here at Yerkes. Carl Sagan is another big name that a lot of people know. If you really are interested in science, have read his Cosmos book or seen the TV series. So Carl Sagan also did his PhD work here. We have this really interesting artifact that he built with his advisor at the time, Kuiper, who's known for naming the outer region of the solar system, the Kuiper Belt. And they built kind of a model of the moon. And so when they took glass plates of the lunar surface, they projected them onto the sphere because you get a lot of really interesting projection effects when you take 2D maps and try to throw them onto 3D or 3D surface and you try to project it on a 2D surface. So we have that here, and over the next year, we'll be kind of building that into an interactive display that people can see as they visit. And the last one is Chandrasekhar. It's the last one that I'll mention right now. He worked here for most of his career and ended up getting a Nobel Prize in 1983 for some of the work that he did on the structure of stars and black holes. And we still have the folks who live here locally have pointed out to me the Chandrasekhar tree, as they call it. He planted it when he was here, and every time he came back to visit it from Chicago in his later life, he would set up a blanket and have a little picnic under the Chandrasekhar tree.
Wow. Wow, that's really interesting. So I just want to say when I took the tour, we got to go through this sort of little upstairs back room that used to be the library. And there is a book in that library with Carl Sagan's name. He signed the little card back when you had to do that to check out a book. And so we all got to look at that. I don't know how long they'll have that out, but that was sort of interesting. Then everyone wanted to look through all the other books and see if there was anyone they recognized.
I have lost several hours in that library doing right. Exactly that. And interestingly, just finding books that people read or wrote in, you know, different time periods and seeing where their mind was at the time when they read that book. And then they went on to do some work that contributed to the studies that I did, you know, 20 years later. Mm-hmm. So it's been really fascinating. And I will admit that I've pulled out some of those cards and signed my own name and put them back in the library. So you might find my name.
I think one of the things that's really fascinating about that sort of library collection or what's left of it right now is just how international this work is. Right? There are people from all over the world contributing and writing and producing books that were in that library back in the 1890s and the 1920s and so forth. I mean, that makes sense. Obviously, if you're looking at the cosmos, it is an international. There are no boundaries in space at the moment. So that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And Hale really made it a point to let people know that they wanted to collect critical writings on the what was known about electricity and magnetism and gravity at the time. And so they actually built a safe. There is a large safe in one of the offices that was built to hold the very important papers that they might have received to take care of for some of the astronomers around the world.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So what, in your opinion, is the greatest scientific breakthrough that occurred at Yerkes?
It is such a hard question, and I'm just going to cheat and not give you a single answer.
Okay.
There's a lot of observatories where you can point to the one single thing that they did, but for me, I think it's the status of Yerkes, this place, being what we would call today an incubator for ideas over the course of 120 years. And so not from starting with the refining of astrophotography to refining how we build mirrors to spectroscopes to different observations to scientists coming and collaborating here and then going off to found infrared astronomy as a field, to found the McDonald Observatory, for Hale to go and build the next biggest telescope in the world, then the next one, then the next one, all in California. So it just seemed like a place. There's just a feeling here that kind of allows you to be really creative and innovative and try out ideas and then go and refine them. I think modern astronomy would be a very different place, would be different in its timeline of discovery had it not been for some of the innovations that scientists passing through Yerkes started and then went out into the world to kind of spread.
So like all science, it's a slow process that builds over time on previous work. So just kind of being the foundation stone of modern astronomy, sort of.
Yeah, absolutely.
So until 2018, the Yerkes Observatory belonged to the University of Chicago. So tell us about who's in charge now and what the goals are.
Yeah, so the university announced that it was going to sell the property and sell the observatory in 2018. So a group of local folks to the area where Yerkes is got together and founded the Yerkes Future Foundation. So this is a nonprofit organization, and they raised money and they took over stewardship of the facility and the grounds from the University of Chicago in 2020. So from that time, their goal has been to raise about $30 million. They've raised about $17 million so far, and they have invested that into the infrastructure of the building, which it needed a lot of work. We replaced the roof. The inside of the big dome had some real problems with some of the brick. It had soaked up a lot of water. It was kind of peeling. The university had not really done a deep clean or really kept up with some of the maintenance that you need to do with a 125-year-old building for a while, which is one of the reasons why they wanted to sell it. They just couldn't keep up with it. So the investment that the Future Foundation put into it is very evident now when you come and visit and walk around the halls. And we put solar powers on the roof. So now we generate about 8 times more energy than what we use every day. And we have generators to be able to help in the event that the power goes out at night. I can still continue to use the telescope. So the Future Foundation, their goal is to really ensure that Yerkes continues to advance astronomy in whatever way makes sense. I mean, it's not a premier site in the world. It's not at a mountaintop in Hawaii or Chile or anywhere else in the world. So you wouldn't think about it in modern terms as a place that you would build a modern observatory. But there are so many ways we can continue to contribute to astronomy and how astronomy is done. Also to use its grounds and visitors and other aspects to create a destination for science, for discovery, a place where people can come and have an experience that combines science and the environment and culture and arts and curiosity in a way that is unlike any other place that I've ever visited in the world. And so just kind of from the ongoing astronomical research to events outside to hosting the building of the tallest glass tree in the world. Mm-hmm. Upcoming in another couple months, we'll be hosting a musical group who will be here for a 2-week lab where they have students and they'll be playing music and composing inside with Yerkes as the inspiration for the work that they'll be doing. On and on and on. So we really just want to help create something that doesn't exist, like a science, education, inspiration, cross-pollinating discovery space.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can just give a little bit of a perspective because I attended the world's tallest glass tree. We went for a tour of the interior of the building and the telescope, but there was the festival was going on outside, and it was a very tall glass tree made out of green bottles, like the kind from Heineken beer, you know, the green beer bottles, green wine bottles, I guess. And so I think the people that were making the tree were from Champaign, Illinois. Is that right?
Yeah.
And they, so they're glass artists, and they created this big frame. And you know, the day we were there, they were still adding to it. So it's basically molten glass that was stretched out in a string. I guess you could, if you've ever seen cotton candy made, it was a little bit like that, only with much smaller strands. So I can't, I mean, they were working on it for a couple of months, right? I mean, it must have
taken... Yeah, we had every weekend in December, we had set up and working. So they would bring in their kiln, and they would take recycled white and green glass and melt it on site, and then kind of stick their stick in it, collect some of the melted glass, and then drip it over the spinning metal frame, so that giant metal frame would just spin around at a certain rate, and you would let the glass drop, and it kind of gets pulled around into this long strand for a while. Then there was next to it a big tent where we had kind of a maker space. There were some demonstrations of glass blowing. We had a metal artist, Ray Ripple, who came to visit one weekend, and you could buy things. We had some local businesses inside at this gift shops. You could get some coffee or hot chocolate. My daughter sat with me at the Yerkes booth for a couple hours one day just because she knew she was going to be able to add glass to the tree. That was the biggest incentive for her. She was so excited.
Yes, I saw little kids adding glass to the tree. It was a little scary, honestly. I was like, oh, that seems like really hot glass. But they were being really careful. So that was what I wanted to emphasize, that it was a whole festival. You know, so we went for the tour. I wanted to see the tree, but I didn't expect all this other stuff. So it was really, really great. And I think both the interior and exterior of the facility just have the space to do those kinds of things. So I think it'll be really delightful to see how it develops over time.
Yeah, one of the things that we wanted was to provide a free event for the community. And part of our vision is to really build a unique community around this historic space. And so that's one of the reasons why I moved into Williams Bay, because I wanted to be part of that local community, even though it was going to be, you know, a regional, international audience that we were actually reaching out to and communicating with over time.
It's a charming little town, from what I can tell.
It really is.
I know somebody who used to teach at Williams Bay Middle School. I don't know what the school is called, but... So I just wanted to take another quick reintroduction. This is WGTV HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert. This is Education Matters. We are discussing the renaissance of the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay and Walworth County with Dr. Amanda Bauer, who's the Deputy Director and Head of Science and Education at Yerkes Observatory. This is going to be archived at WGTV.org on the Education Matters page in case you're tuning in the middle and you want to hear the rest of it. Or you're invited to listen again there, or you can find our WGTV Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. We're going to share all the Yerkes social media stuff toward the end of the show. One of the things I wanted to point out, though, is that in addition to the telescopes and the brilliant scientists and all the science that's going on, is that Yerkes is housed in an architecturally significant building surrounded by absolutely stunning grounds. Can you tell us a little more about them?
Absolutely. When you even turn off of the main Geneva Street to come onto the grounds, there's just kind of calming that you feel as you drive along and you come up to that ellipse, which would have been for the initial people who had to ride on their horses to come and drop things off as you enter the grounds and see the building. The building itself was designed by architect Henry Ives Cobb, he was a famous architect in Chicago at the time, and he had contributed the Newberry Library and some of the buildings on the University of Chicago campus. And so Hale had given him the original basic layout for what he wanted in the facility, and then Cobb sort of went wild and designed a really extravagant and symbolic, meaningful, and quirky building that just feels fun to come to. I can only imagine people with an architectural background enjoying this space. There's marble walls all over the interior. There's this huge rotunda when you walk in that has a skylight above it, and it's got columns that are carved out both in the entryway when you go in that have caricatures of some of the main figures of the time who contributed to culture and Yerkes itself. So Charles Yerkes is a face that's featured quite a bit. And he was not a very well-liked person, and so the people sort of made fun of him a little bit, and he's got devil horns. So he's all over the outside of the building and the inside, and you can see him with various, like his mustache is upturned, or it's downturned, or he's got a pirate patch over one eye at some point. It's pretty funny. And then Rockefeller is one of the faces on there, and Harper, who was the president of the University of Chicago. All of the animals that are around in the architecture have to do with flight or with nighttime. So there's owls spreading their wings, and the whole design sort of takes your eye upward as a nod to kind of the nighttime astronomy aspect of what was going to be happening in that building.
Right. That it is just kind of amazing. And the tour guide that we had in December did a great job of pointing out all those little details that you might not even have noticed that those were faces. You just sort of see, oh, it's very ornate. But if you look carefully, you can see all the really intense detail. And then the grounds, what can you tell us about them?
So Yerkes right now sits on 50 acres of grounds that were beautifully landscaped and originally planned by the Olmsted brothers. And they were the sons of the famous Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park in New York and the Washington Monument grounds and things like that. So it was about 10 years after the observatory was finished that they did this design. And there's just a huge number of old growth trees. There's a really beautiful ginkgo tree. And since then, we've come in and tried to restore those grounds to as close as their original vision, but modernizing it in kind of appropriate ways. So we're putting in some trails that go around the grounds. There'll be some fully accessible trails. We're incorporating a landscape tour this summer, so you'll get to learn a lot more about what you see around on the grounds. We've planted a pollinator garden, which is just beautiful when it starts to bloom. And then behind that, there's an apiary. So a local couple built these beautiful bee boxes that sit back there. There's about five, and we incorporated some bees last summer. And it was just so fun to kind of go over and see them happily enjoying this pollinator garden, which will then go to benefit all of the farms and landscape around this region.
Okay, so you've already said a little bit about this, but what are some specific efforts to restore the buildings and grounds, and how are they progressing?
We have done a big sweep of the grounds to take away some of the overgrowth. I can't remember what the name of the local kind of overgrowth that grows on close to the ground under the trees was really covering a lot of the grounds. So they took a lot of that away. We went through and tried to get rid of some of the diseased trees and things like that. Replanted some things that had been, like some patches in the grass that need to be replanted. We redid the roof on the Yerkes building and put in solar panels all the way across, and also put in a water reclamation system. And so whenever it rains, we collect that water, it flows through the building and down under the ground and out to water some of the native garden landscape patches that we've planted. And then also it goes and feeds down into the lake down the hill. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a lot of work across the whole property to try to just restore, protect, and benefit the local flora and fauna as well.
So you briefly mentioned Yerkes, who's the person that the grounds are named after. He is not an astronomer.
No.
What is who's Charles Yerkes?
Charles Tyson Yerkes. He was a financial tycoon in Chicago and probably one of the most hated men in Chicago for a while. He was responsible for the development of the L train system in Chicago. So that's one of the things that built up his fortune. But he was not afraid to use bribery or blackmail or, you know, whatever means he needed to in order to get what he wanted. So in his status as a not well-liked person, Hale and Harper found an opportunity to go to him and see if he wanted to fund this. At first, it was a telescope. They knew the mirrors were available, and they didn't have a home. They didn't have an observatory to go to. And so Hale wanted a financier to bring those there and then said, oh, well, you can also they need a telescope to go in so you can fund the structure. Oh, but they need a building to go around them. And so they pitched it to him that this was going to be a premier astronomical site of the world, and it would reinvigorate his name and build his reputation back up. So that he ended up agreeing to that and paid for the full construction cost of Yerkes Observatory. It was about $800,000 at the time, which is something like $34 million today. But he was all for it. But it didn't completely save his reputation. He went on to do some other shady things around Chicago and ended up getting run out of town and moved to London eventually and had a hand in building the underground there. So he was quite a character.
Well, I mean, we're still saying his name multiple times just in this show. So I guess in the sense of being remembered, it may have worked for him.
It sure did.
On some level. So, Amanda, you are the head of science and education. So tell us about some of the ideas and plans that you have to connect Yerkes to local schools and to adults who want to learn more.
Absolutely. So we are just now starting to invite school groups back in for specialized tours and experiences speaking with some of our professional astronomers on staff. We're setting up special evening programs to experience the wonder of the night sky and get to look through some of our telescopes. Those will be starting to be introduced this summer. We're also updating some of the telescope facilities, because one of the things I really want to do is offer them as training grounds for students, for members of the public, for astronomers who don't have access to this class of telescopes to really learn how they work. And so I have lots of projects for summer students to come in where they can use, say, our 24-inch reflecting telescope and observe the path that asteroids follow around the solar system. They can look at stars that vary their brightness over time, and then compare those observations to some of the glass plate data that we have here and see what these stars looked like 100 years ago. This is one of the longest baseline pieces of data that we have in astronomy to understand how objects change over time. And so I'll also be getting some students involved in the process of digitizing those glass plates. We can scan them in kind of a modern commercial scanner, teach them how to run some astronomical code, and then they can actually compare them to more recent images and discover anything that might have been hidden on those plates that we didn't know for 100 years because we just didn't have the technology to be able to find them. And so many opportunities for students and members of the public to get involved. We have some volunteer days often that people can kind of come in and help us out with different projects. And I'm just really excited to get the opportunity for schools, for students, for people to come in and look at the telescopes, use the telescopes, and kind of experience the grandeur of the past, and also taking them through to the power that they have in the technology we have in our pockets today. We can do so much even with our cell phones to contribute to astronomy and science education right now.
So for listeners, what is the best way for them to learn more about Yerkes?
There are lots of ways. You can visit our website. It's yerkesobservatory.org. You can go there to sign up for one of our tours with Jana, who you've heard about.
Let's spell Yerkes. I realize we've not done that yet, just in case people don't
right.
know.
So Y-E-R-K-E-S is how you spell Yerkes. And a lot of people just reading it don't know how it's pronounced. So I like to point out that we've got some wild turkeys that run around on our lawn out here.
So those are the Yerkes turkeys, except it's not quite spelled like turkey either.
Exactly.
Y-E-R-K-E-S, everyone. So that's the first place. Where else can they go?
You can follow us on social media. We're also hosting a star party, our inaugural star party for the Yerkes Future Foundation on March 17th. So you can find a link for that at the website. And I also wanted to say that we're going to be hiring a full-time educator to help with some of this interaction with schools and just the experience that young people have when they come visit Yerkes. And so you can look for that announcement. Probably in the next few weeks, I'll be opening that up.
Great. So I like to end my interviews for Education Matters with stories about real people. So I know you haven't been there long, but do you have a story or two that you can share about something that happened at Yerkes since you've started there?
I didn't notice this question on the form.
Right, there you go. Well, I'm putting you on the spot. See, listeners, we are real people doing things in real time. Well, what about for you? Is there anything like sort of fascinating that happened for you?
One of my favorite parts about working here is learning about all the old systems. I mean, when we started with Yerkes Future Foundation, we didn't continue with any of the old engineers that had worked here. And for the majority of them, they're, you know, in their 70s and 80s now, so they're not at a place where they can come back. And so I've been inviting the ones back that are still around this area and just hearing their stories. And there's so many who can't describe in words how something works, but if they get near it, their hands just find it. They've got that kind of muscle memory for how things move around. And it's really fascinating just to be able to learn so much from those folks. And when I walk around, we keep finding these little treasures that somehow have lasted for 100 years. For instance, I opened up a case of glass plates to show someone and noticed this little box that said Kenwood Observatory, and it was a stack of glass plates that had been taken by George Hale in his Kenwood Observatory in Chicago, probably around 1890, and they were little images of the sun. And I didn't even know that that collection of glass plates was there. And so every other week, it feels like we're just discovering some instrument or piece of technology or piece of paper with notes scribbled on it and trying to put the story together for how it was used and how we can tell that story or put these things into use again in the future at Yerkes.
Yeah, so I would encourage listeners, if you have any interest at all in history, in science, in architecture, in botany or any of those things, sort of it just hit every button, and I am not a scientist. It just, I find the place and the idea of the place fascinating on a lot of levels. And I mentioned at the beginning that there's a film. It's not a great movie, but it's a great movie if you want to see what Yerkes looks like in the winter. The film is called Chain Reaction. It's a 1996 movie starring Keanu Reeves and Morgan Freeman. Not a great movie, but really, really beautiful views, aerial views, and views from the lake of Yerkes, and a lot of really good shots of the telescope. So if you are dying to know, that might be a place to look. But also just, I don't know, it's just, I think it's really fascinating, and I encourage everyone that's listening to this show to go and see. I'm going to put in the show notes on the archive, we'll include all the links that we talked about, and also on the Facebook page. So if you are listening and you find us on our Facebook page, you should be able to get through to the Yerkes website, maybe sign up to go on a tour sometime soon or attend one of the events that we've been talking about. Thank you so much, Dr. Amanda Bauer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's been a delight to talk with you. We could have gone on and on, as you probably can already tell. So I just am really grateful to you, Amanda Bauer, Deputy Director and Head of Science and Education at Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay. So this is Education Matters, and this discussion about Yerkes Observatory is archived at WGTV.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTV Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org. Support comes from Offsite, functioning as an integrated part of your business's IT staff, providing 24/7 support. Reduce your organization's technology risk by partnering with Offsite's team of local engineers. Visit off-site.com/radio.
Well, this week on WGTD's Noon Tunes to kick off the new year, we're featuring the music of South Milwaukee-based singer-songwriter Mark Richard. At the end of every WGTD midday newscast, we feature a song by a local artist. So come on and join us for Noon Tunes, Monday through Friday, 12:20 p.m. here on WGTD HD. Support comes from UW Parkside's Adventures in Lifelong Learning, offering seniors a variety of activities to stay engaged and healthy, including hiking, lectures, bridge, current affairs, discussion groups, and book clubs that meet via Zoom. To learn more, visit uwp.edu/ALL.
This is WGTD HD serving Kenosha.